Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is Science and the 4th of July, a special production of The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia. It's a nice summer day here, and throngs of tourists are walking along well-worn cobblestone roads. They're catching carriage rides, lining up to see the Liberty Bell, and of course,
Independence Hall, where they wrote the greatest document ever written.
The Declaration of Independence.
So this is the perfect place to ask people what they love about the 4th of July.
Fireworks, always fireworks.
Hot dogs, hamburgers, just grilling out.
The independence, the freedom. Fireworks, hot dogs. Can I go on?
Fireworks, a lot of fireworks.
Having a flag out displayed at our home.
The patriotic feeling that day.
And fireworks.
During this hour, we'll dig into the science that makes those fireworks sparkle, that makes flags durable and hot dogs delicious, although not exactly healthy. We'll also explore what brain researchers are learning about the pursuit of happiness and about feelings of patriotism. But let's start at the beginning and how science figured into the founding of this country. If you walk across the street from Independence Hall, you'll get to the American Philosophical Society. Many of the founding fathers were major science geeks. Franklin, Madison, Jefferson, Washington, and this was their hangout.
The colonies were maturing, and they needed an institution that helped unite the greatest minds in America to share all the discoveries that were happening in the various colonies.
Ben Franklin founded the society in 1743.
And so it's called the Philosophical Society because in the 18th century, philosophy meant inquiry.
Patrick Spiro is the librarian here, and he's filled up a cart with carefully preserved papers and documents for us to look at. He pulls out a small book.
Here's one of our treasures that was gifted to us by Dolly Madison. And it was her husband's meteorological diary. And what James Madison did was record every day the weather on Mount Pelier. And you can see here the date of June, where the wind came from, the weather at sunrise, the weather at 6 p.m. And sometimes he'll put even different notes there, like wild geese flying by.
And how beautiful is his handwriting.
Oh, it's perfect. And that's that just shows you how much he knew he needed to use this. He'd be referring back to it. Asparagus at dinner, he's recording what he's eating. Hummingbirds up here. Tulips blooming. So he's able to understand the patterns that are developing on Mount Pelier.
Think about what was happening in the world when Madison observed those hummingbirds. It's the late 18th century, an incredibly exciting time for scientific innovation. Isaac Newton's laws of motion had fundamentally changed the way people looked at the world around them.
And the shift to realize we can understand the world in which we live. People began to say, hey, what else can we start to understand if we study it and discover laws that are universal?
The mercury thermometer had been invented, the lightning rod, the electric telegraph, a submarine. It was as if science could unlock endless possibilities, and the founders were inspired by this way of thinking.
Thomas Jefferson was a scientist. He was interested in every potential subject. George Washington was always experimenting with new modes of husbandry. He was adopting early technologies that was meant to improve the productivity of his farm. Look at Franklin, started as a printer, experimented with electricity. So Franklin always approached problems that would help the world.
They had scientific minds, and that echoes in the famous words they wrote in the Declaration of Independence.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people
to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station
to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
The laws of nature, nature's God.
And it really comes down to a realization that the natural world could be explained, that it ran by laws. The idea that you could understand the natural world opened up the idea that, well, there are other things we can understand. We don't just have to defer to a monarchy because that's the way it's always been, and that these are absolute monarchs appointed by God. We can study government and come up with a better form of government.
And one of their guiding ideas was that good governments should have order and balance.
And when that balance gets lost, things in government begin to go haywire. So they're thinking about it kind of like you might think of a chemistry experiment where you're adding different variables or elements to it. And what they said in the lead up to the American Revolution is that the British government had lost that balance. And so with the Constitution, you have an executive, you have a Senate, and you have a Congress, and you have an independent judiciary. This is really political science as we think about it today. And I would note that it's political science. It is the study of government. And by studying government, good government, bad government, the idea was at the time that they could come up with a great model.
Patrick Spiro is the librarian at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. We're talking about science and the 4th of July, and the Founding Fathers' continuous chase to find a better way rings true for people today. We value innovation, we still want to understand the world around us, but one way we're pretty different in the 21st century is that we are really interested in understanding ourselves, what makes us tick. We love self-improvement, becoming better, faster, more efficient, and happier. When the founders wrote about the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, they were concerned with the purpose of good government, which should protect its citizens' life, liberty, their ability to thrive. But we're after a different kind of happiness, one in our daily lives, and a gigantic research field has sprung up around this. Shuka Kalantari reports.
We can learn to be happy. It's a skill we develop with time, kind of like mastering yoga or chess. That's the takeaway from people who study happiness. One of their suggestions? Keep a gratitude journal. I'm a pretty happy person, but I'm a mom with a very active toddler. And I work. I get stressed out sometimes. There definitely are unhappy moments. So I tried it out for a week. I wrote a daily list of things I'm thankful for. Like the sound of my kid throwing pebbles into the marina by our house. I'm also grateful for my toddler's love of music. He likes to sing me his version of the Sesame Street classic, Elmo's Song.
Dad, Mama, Dad, Baba, Dad.
The people I love make me happier. That was the common thread in my journaling. Decades of research echo this. Strong social relationships are a key to happiness, and that's good for our health.
Feeling good about life and feeling like you have purpose and meaning and happiness adds years to your life expectancy.
Dacher Keltner teaches psychology at UC Berkeley, and he's a leading researcher in this field. He says these happy feelings are good for our bodies.
They affect your nervous system. They affect levels of cortisol. They lower it, the stress hormone. They influence the vagus nerve, which I study in my lab, which is a big bundle of nerves in your body that calms your body down and helps you connect to others.
Dacher is a positive psychologist. He studies emotions like happiness and awe and empathy and how they affect our health. The findings of his studies and others are implemented in schools around the country. Preschools have meditation circles alongside their reading circles. High school students go on mindful nature hikes to combat depression. Dacher says we'll be seeing these practices in the healthcare field next.
A lot of the data show that doctors and nurses are really burned out and they are fried, that patients are enormously stressed. And so they're starting to think about, and you see this in hospital settings, like how do you beautify hospital settings to take advantage of the benefits of nature? Can you have a little room where people can go and meditate or do yoga?
And it's not just healthcare. Silicon Valley tech companies are now hiring happiness consultants. HR managers are often called chief happiness officers. UC Berkeley neuroscientist Emiliana Simon-Thomas says keeping employees happy is good for a company's bottom line.
There are lots of costs associated with turnover and stress-related illnesses. And I think the idea that happy workers is something that matters to an organization is a growing one.
But not everybody is so eager to jump on this train. John Grohol offers up some shade to throw on this ray of happiness. He's a psychologist and the founder of the mental health website, PsychCentral.org.
The core happiness levels, the core optimism levels that we experience in life those are genetically predetermined, that you can't change those.
New research suggests that about half of your baseline happiness, perhaps what you'd call your general outlook on life, is inherited. Plus, he says a lot of these studies are done in labs, with college students required to participate in experiments for class credit. They're never duplicated on more diverse groups.
And this is a problem for a number of reasons. A university college student in America really does not represent the humanness of all people everywhere, and certainly not all age groups.
Another issue happiness scientists have grappled with is what happiness really means. Today, most psychologists agree happiness is not defined as perpetual pleasure, not even in children's movies. Here's Dacher Keltner again.
I was involved in the film Inside Out, where I was a scientific consultant for that.
The movie's about emotions, like joy and sadness and anger, personified inside the mind of an 11-year-old girl named Riley. In one scene, Sadness, who's played by Mindy Kaling, is consoling Riley's imaginary friend, because Riley is growing out of her need to play with him.
We were best friends.
Yeah, it's sad.
And it really was about, hey, life gets really sad, right? And that's okay. In fact, sadness is beautiful, and sadness has wisdom, and sadness moves you forward into personal growth.
When I journaled about things I'm grateful for, it wasn't all happy things. I also wrote about getting to spend 20 minutes with a friend a few weeks before an illness took his life. It's a happy memory intertwined with a very sad one. There's still lots of questions about happiness science, but some of it seems intuitively right. Like that building good relationships and reflecting on what we're grateful for makes us happier people. It may or may not add years to my life, but writing about skipping pebbles on the beach with my toddler definitely makes me feel happy.
Rocks.
And that's something.
Get some rocks. Now let's throw them in the water. Ready?
1, 2, 3.
That was Shuka Kalantari reporting.
Good job, Sina.
When we ask people what makes them happy on the 4th of July, here's something we heard a lot.
Some hot dogs.
Hot dogs.
Hot dogs!
They are so American and so delicious, but they're also not very good for you. So, should we eat them anyway? We asked reporter Alana Gordon to check in with a nutritionist.
We begin the story where most barbecues begin. At the grocery store.
We're going to stop at the special item of the week, the hot dog.
That's Nairi Dardarian. We head toward the meat section of Acme, a grocery chain on the East Coast. Along the way, we hit a refrigerated shelf full of Franks.
I've never seen this before. It's a hot dog station.
Nairi is a registered dietitian who teaches nutrition at Drexel University. So she wants to know what is in them.
And I'm going to take a look at the label.
First, calories.
And I'm looking at this 160 calories for the whole hot dog.
Then fat.
120 of those calories come from fat.
What's your reaction to that?
That's a lot of fat. I don't really want to eat fat on a bun.
The last thing she looks at is sodium content.
Kind of a rule of thumb is don't go over 300 milligrams of sodium for one serving of any type of food.
Too much salt can lead to high blood pressure, heart disease, long list of not so nice things. Most of these dogs go over that threshold.
So I guess we're going to make a decision here.
She grabs a few different kinds and includes some veggie, turkey, lean, and low sodium options and heads out.
Okay, so the lettuce looks good. Nice and chopped.
It's the next day, and Nairi has a party to cook for. The hot dogs are out, but she's also making an Armenian-style salad. It's a combination of cracked wheat, tomato, parsley, and olive oil.
Then you don't feel as guilty if you balance your hot dog out with a side that's full of really good whole grains and lettuce, tomatoes.
For Nairi, it's all about padding an occasional hot dog with nutritional sides, not a bag of chips or a second hot dog. She heads outside for the last step.
Okay, grill is lit. Let this heat up.
Studies have shown that cooking at high temperatures, like on a grill, is associated with colon cancer. There's some evidence that marinating could reduce that risk. Still, Nairi says we've been grilling for a millennia. The key is don't do it all the time. Nairi's guests arrive. They're not your typical everyday guests.
My name is Leah Joy.
My name is Ben Graff.
Danny Talenti.
They've all just graduated from Drexel's nutrition program.
My name is Jessica Liu.
Coco Ellis.
So they're experts. Back outside.
So we're just putting these on the grill.
Nairi lays out several options.
Your authentic ballpark hot dog. Then we have a spin on that.
A lean one, less calories but still high in fat. And there's a veggie dog. It's low fat, but still has a lot of sodium.
Are any of these, like, better or worse?
I would say no. They are all on the same scale of hot dog.
Some hot dogs at health food stores advertise being lower in fat with less additives. For Nairi, it's a hot dog, so there's trade-offs.
All right, who's going to dig into the hot dog bar?
Ben pretty much inhales an authentic ballpark hot dog. He's thrown out the nutrition label.
Yeah, I'm not going to eat a hot dog all the time, but if I'm going to have one, I'm just going to go for it.
Ben was obviously paying attention to Nairi's approach. I'm vegetarian, so I grab a veggie dog.
What do you think?
The ketchup and onions help.
This is getting better.
But still, it's not so great.
Okay, here I go.
Nairi decides to give the low-fat, low-sodium white turkey hot dog a try. She looks disappointed.
It's not nearly as spicy as a regular hot dog.
She says next time she'll opt for a regular one. But that next time, it's not going to be for a while.
I think I just take a hot dog for what it is. It's a hot dog.
Do be eaten rarely, like, say, on the 4th of July. And beyond being mindful of portion sizes and balancing sides, just don't forget the best part of any good barbecue, the ritual of sharing good laughs and friendship.
Hot dog cheers!
That was Alana Gordon reporting while eating veggie dogs. Science shaped the thinking of the men who wrote the Declaration of Independence, and it also brings us many of the things we love about this holiday. For example, fireworks. How do they work? Liz Reed answers that burning question.
Matt Klein, who's 43, is a chemical engineering lab instructor at Carnegie Mellon University, but he's been playing with explosives since he was a kid, growing up in the Cincinnati suburbs.
We were kind of feral kids. certainly there was no kind of helicoptering parents.
The youngest of four children, Matt had some freedom while his parents were busy dealing with his older siblings. To fill the time, he did odd jobs and reinvested his earnings.
You know, I would mow lawns in the summer and would take the money that I would earn and go down to the drugstore. And for a dollar, you could buy a bottle of zinc powder, and for 79 cents, flowers of sulfur. And for $1.29, you could get a bottle of potassium nitrate.
Matt says with those three items, he created a mixture that would burn slowly and fill the entire vacant lot behind his house with smoke. Through his experiments and with the encouragement of his science teacher, Matt learned the basics of how to make stuff catch fire.
You have to have a fuel and an oxidizer and a source of ignition.
For the next step, to make something explode, you just have to house the fire inside of a container. By the time he was in eighth grade, Matt was making small explosives in a supervised way at school and making homemade rockets in an unsupervised way out of school.
If you can make rockets on your own and you have some ability to make things blow up a little bit, you're most of the way towards thinking about making fireworks, right? I'm going to shoot this thing up and I'm going to get it to blow up and hopefully make color.
The anatomy of a firework is actually fairly simple. The main component is a ball, maybe 6 inches in diameter. The outer shell is made of something that catches fire easily, like paper. To create that starburst look, the outer ball is packed with smaller components called stars, each designed to burn with a certain color and brightness.
And when I have those, I'll arrange them and structure them in a way such that when they go up and explode, they're going to be distributed in the sky a certain way.
Different chemicals serve different purposes. Some are there just to provide oxygen. Some are there to act as fuel. Some do both. Other chemicals make colors. Strontium nitrate makes things burn red. Copper burns blue. Once assembled, you put the ball of chemical materials into a mortar, a tube to shoot it out of.
So you launch the thing up into the sky, and you have to have fuses or some sort of time delay that is burning the whole time.
When the fuse burns down, the firework explodes, sending those little flaming balls out into the sky. Matt's amateur pyrotechnics career was cut short when he was a freshman in high school. he and a friend accidentally exploded a metal carbon dioxide cartridge, sending shrapnel into his stomach, hands, and head.
When I came out of surgery and my dad had arrived at the hospital, he had a pack of sparklers. And basically what he told me was, don't play with anything more dangerous than this until you really know what you're doing. And that got me started down a path of chemistry.
Matt doesn't build explosives at home anymore, but he does have a stash of explosive materials in the lab at Carnegie Mellon. He climbs up onto a chair and starts rummaging around in a high cabinet.
There's some stuff up here I didn't remember that we had.
Matt grabs a few more bottles.
All right, this is enough for us to take up to play with.
And we carry the tray of chemicals to a back room to light them on fire. These days, it's safety first, so Matt sets everything up behind a protective chemistry hood, and we both put on plastic safety glasses. He grabs the flash powder, pretty much the same mixture he was making with drugstore ingredients back in eighth grade, and spoons a small amount on top of a metal coil, then turns on the power supply to heat up the coil.
And there we go. So did you see that red color? That red color and the sparkliness? That's the strontium nitrate that's giving that red. If we did not have that salt in there, we would have no red color.
Next, we try gunpowder.
All right, are your eyes covered?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go. Nice. That little thump noise, I never get tired of that.
Liz Reed reported this story. She spoke with chemical engineer Matt Klein. And that powerful urge to experiment with fireworks that he described, a lot of people feel that. They want to push the boundaries and not just light a fuse on a Roman candle. John Humphrey is that guy, the one in the neighborhood who wants to host the best pyrotechnic display on July 4th. Every summer, it was bigger, louder, more spectacular than the last. Until one fateful year, here's John telling his cautionary tale. It was the summer of 2003.
So when everybody gathered at my house and all the neighbors had gathered and been sufficiently lubricated with drink, I started the show and 10 of the mortars went up. And oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. As soon as they went off, I could see the embers from their fuses drifting to the ground over the rest of the display. And almost immediately after that, you know, hell broke out. The mortars on the ground started discharging in every direction. I mean, it's still terrifying to think about. It took a half a second before people to realize, uh-oh, something really went wrong. These huge explosions weren't happening 300 feet in the air. They're happening at ground level and whizzing by. And so people that were on my driveway were diving for cover. And it was just dead silent. I mean, the whole neighborhood was dead silent. And there was the creepy smoke just kind of wafting past. And I just started running around screaming, is anybody hurt? Is everybody okay? Looking around, I saw my patio umbrella shredded like a Civil War flag. And some young kid says, dude, there's a hole in your house. There was, in fact, a hole about a yard in diameter in the back of my kitchen. And there was smoke just coming out. And I thought, oh my God, my kids are in there. So I ran inside and there was smoke hugging the ceiling. My oldest sister had, at that point, burst through the front door. She grabbed my son and said, I've got your kids. We're going. And I, great. I mean, that was one thing I didn't have to deal with. The kitchen was destroyed, absolutely destroyed. When the mortar hit the back of the house, it hit a stud, pulverized it. It blew the cabinets off the wall. All the dishes that were in there were strewn across the hardwood floors in pieces. If anybody had been in the house, they would have been instantly killed. I repeat, the luckiest man on the face of the earth. The only person who got hit with anything, miraculously, was my oldest niece, who was 150 feet across the street. It just stung. But as a matter of precaution, my sister took her to the emergency room. My sister did not know at the time she took her to the emergency room that any injury resulting from these illegal fireworks triggered this newly enacted provision of the anti-terrorism bill, the domestic explosives provision, such that if you have illegal fireworks and there's any physical injury, you can be prosecuted under federal law. And it had just taken effect within the 30 days preceding this 4th of July. 2 days later, I was home late afternoon taking a nap. My wife came up and said, "Wake up, wake up. There's two ATF agents at the door." Well, sure enough, they had intended to file federal criminal charges. The bottom line was they wanted to know where I got these explosives. And she said, "You know what? I know where you got them, and I'll tell them. I am not going to visit your ass in Leavenworth with three little kids." And eventually she did. She convinced me that if I wanted to avoid this prosecution, I had to cooperate. The ATF agent advised me that they would be keeping an eye on me. So we don't have snakes at my house. We don't have sparklers. The 4th of July, I stay inside. And I listen to the amateurs in the neighborhood lighting off their little consumer fireworks. I still put on the coolest Halloween in the world. And that's a true fact. You can ask my neighbors.
That was John Humphrey of Kansas City. This story was produced and sound designed by Sylvia Maria Gross. A lot of people are going to spend at least part of the sweltering hot 4th of July in a dark and air-conditioned movie theater, and one of them will be Alan Yu. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Maiken.
I know you're a big movie fan. What are you going to see on the holiday?
So I'm going to go watch Baby Driver. It's an action comedy about a getaway driver called Baby, but I'm also really looking forward to Spider-Man Homecoming, which is the newest Spider-Man movie.
And you're also a major science geek, which is why it's great that you're working on The Pulse, but do you pay attention to science in movies?
I pay attention to the science when it's done particularly well or when it's distractingly bad.
Like what? Give me an example of really bad science in movies.
The easy example is the cinema classic Armageddon, which, if you recall, the premise is that there's an asteroid the size of Texas heading towards Earth and they send oil drillers up to blow it up.
And what's so bad about that?
Let's start with the premise. The whole movie revolves around the idea that it's easier to train oil drillers to become astronauts rather than teaching astronauts how to use a drill.
And I guess there are lots of other mistakes in that movie. But we're also hearing a lot more about Hollywood working with scientists to get things right. I'm thinking about The Martian, for example.
So The Martian is special because the film crew got to tour some NASA sites. NASA gave them a lot of pictures of Mars, you know, advised them on what storms on Mars would look like. So they put in a lot of work to make sure that it looked accurate. But let's say you're a film director, you just want to make sure your movie doesn't break every single law of physics. So there's a number you can call, 844-NEED-SCI, and yes, that's an actual number. And that number goes to the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and that's a program from the National Academy of Sciences. And one person that you might get on the line is Clifford Johnson.
I'm Clifford Johnson. I'm a professor of physics at the University of Southern California.
The most recent movie he worked on is Thor Ragnarok, the Marvel movie coming out in November. Fans are super excited.
Well, it's a long story.
He can't talk about that movie because he signed a non-disclosure agreement with Marvel. But to use a safe example, he worked with the writers of the Marvel TV show Agent Carter, a spin-off about the popular character in the Captain America movies.
They had an energy source from the Marvel comics that they wanted to use.
It's kind of a magical substance that can absorb all the energy around it.
They said, well, we need it to do this, that, and this other thing. Tell us what it is, please, and how does it work? And so it reminded me of something that people work on called perfect fluids. And so I was sort of explaining the kinds of perfect fluids with various sort of quantum properties that this might be.
Which the writers used.
So what is it? I have a hypothesis. Do you know what a perfect fluid is?
Are you talking about zero matter or your winemaking machine?
And they didn't just take Clifford's advice. Anne Merchant from the Exchange says talking to him affected casting for a major character.
They wanted to speak to a physicist. We introduced them to Clifford. I can't say he's African-American because he's British, but he's black, and sat down with him. Well, the character then was written as a black man. And they said, well, yeah, because how could we? I mean, we had him in our head after that. So, you know, we know that by making these introductions that they impact story and they impact character.
Her colleague Rick Lover, the director of The Exchange, agrees. And he says these introductions change the way people see scientists.
I constantly am getting this sort of note back from Hollywood like, wow, I was really surprised how like how hip that scientist was. And, you know, scientists and engineers, they are hip.
Rick says part of the point of The Exchange is to make sure writers and directors get to know actual scientists. That's why they organize retreats and science speed dating events where scientists get to talk about their work. Rick says that if you think about it, scientists and filmmakers have quite a bit in common. They have to have creative ideas, explain the idea to people to get funding, then look at numbers to see if their big project succeeded or failed. Clifford says it's more than that. He says scientists, like filmmakers, are storytellers.
When we're trying to discover how something works, we're also looking for mechanism, which translates into story writing, things like motivation. How does that character get past all those obstacles? Why are they trying to do it? What's the motivating reason? All those things that get you watching a drama, that happens in a scientific story as well.
Now, we should say not all his colleagues feel this way.
There's perhaps a perception that I'm sort of goofing off with my Hollywood buddies when it comes to things like movies.
He says some scientists are afraid that Hollywood writers might go with a creative interpretation of science even after talking to them. There's one recent movie in particular that worried mental health specialists. Clinical psychologist Bethany Brand explains that the movie Split features a character with dissociative identity disorder. It used to be called multiple personality disorder.
I've never seen a case like this before. 23 identities live in Kevin's body.
The main character is portrayed as a man who's extraordinarily violent and preys upon other people.
There's a man here. He abducted us and he's going to kill me.
And that's just not the reality of what the disorder is like in almost all cases.
She says the movie could make people who have this disorder feel ashamed.
And I've absolutely heard that from my patients and from other patients. They feel much more like they have to hide their disorder. And that may deter some people from going in and getting treatment. When Hollywood's doing that with films, they're doing all of us a disservice.
Bethany says people with the disorder don't harm other people, but they are at higher risk of harming themselves.
I've heard about a number of patients around the world who've heard from their friends, you know, when are you going to switch? When is your murderer part going to come out and get me? And their friends and loved ones aren't always joking.
I contacted director M. Night Shyamalan for an interview and did not hear back. Bethany says obviously this movie isn't a documentary, but she also says there's also no reason why the director and stars can't talk about the real disorder when they promote the movie. There's going to be a sequel to Split, and she says she would be happy to help out with the science. By and large, Rick Lover, the director of The Exchange, says Hollywood writers do care about getting things right. He told me about a conversation he had with writer John Spaihts. His movie, The Mummy, came out earlier this summer.
What he loves about exchange consults and about talking to scientists is to get to the point in his research where he either gets kind of a shrug or a we're not sure, or maybe even an argument between two field experts.
Because once we reach the limits of real science, that's where science fiction begins. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
Fourth of July is covered in red, white, and blue. We put up flags everywhere or wave them at parades, And what those flags are made of, past and present, tells a story of changing textile science over time. I took a walk over to the workshop of America's most famous flag maker, Betsy Ross.
Always a pleasure it is to be able to have friends come. And thy name again?
Maiken.
This is historical interpreter Carol Spaked. She wears a long dress and a white cap, and this woman never breaks character.
Maiken? What a lovely name that is. Very unusual. Mine is Betsy. Most friends know me as Betsy Ross. That was my name when I made Washington's flag.
As the story goes, Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag. We know for sure that she was a Philadelphia upholsterer, and she did make flags. And she told me that around the time of the Revolutionary War, flags were made from linen, cotton, silk, or wool. And those woolen flags were flown from the masts of naval ships.
Why wool?
Several different reasons. First of all, it is an animal fiber. Therefore, it will dye better without any difficulty. And secondly, and more importantly, the oils within it will better protect that cloth from the salt water, the wind, and the sun. Wool flags will get wet, but they will dry much, much faster than a flag that would be made of cotton or a flag that would be made of linen.
Betsy, or Carol, explains that there is also a special woolen cloth called bunting that protected these flags from the elements.
Bunting is loosely woven, allowing the air to come through. For if the air would resist the flag will be more susceptible to stretching and pulling and losing its shape. But if the air goes through, no resistance.
There was just one catch about bunting. It had to be imported from England.
It is quite an irony, is it not? When I made Washington's flag, it was treason against England, but sewn on England's cloth.
Things really changed in flag making when synthetic fibers were developed in the 1930s.
So nylon is really the world's first synthetic fiber.
That's Regina Lee Blaschek. She teaches history at the University of Leeds in England. And she told me nylon is engineered from chemicals found in coal. And so for the fiber, what was sort of the wish list? What did they have in mind in terms of what this fiber was supposed to be like and accomplish?
The goals were for nylon were to create a fiber that was strong, transparent, and prettier than silk.
And cheaper?
And cheaper than silk, yes.
Nylon was first used in toothbrushes and for ladies' stockings. It was a huge hit. But then during World War II, all of the nylon being produced went to the war effort.
Could be called the fiber that helped to win the war. It replaced silk in parachutes.
After the war, nylon became ubiquitous in household products, in clothing, and of course, flags.
The most famous moment, I think, in the history of nylon occurs in the late 1960s when Neil Armstrong, the first man to step on the moon, plants the American flag on the moon, and that flag is made out of nylon.
Columbia, Columbia, this is Houston, AOS, over. They're setting up the flag now. They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the left.
When I was at the Betsy Ross house, I got to witness a little moment that speaks to what this holiday means to people. Betsy does this neat little trick. She folds a piece of paper, and she makes one single continuous cut
of my scissors
to produce a perfect star. So she and I are chatting. She gives me one of these stars, and she's showing me around in the museum, and then a visitor comes up to her.
I know you don't remember me, but I was here about 12 years ago.
He's tall. He has broad shoulders and a high and tight haircut. He pulls out his wallet and fishes out one of Betsy's stars.
Oh, gracious sir! Thou has thy star.
I keep it in my wallet.
That I gave to thee.
I've been in the military for 27 and a half years, and I always carry this with me.
Oh, sir. Yeah. I must say, I must thank thee for thy service.
Thank you.
He got teary-eyed, and so did I. It was really sweet, fueled by a sense of connection and patriotism. So why do we feel this? Why do we go to parades on the 4th or make a cake with red, white, and blue icing? I talked to Emile Bruneau about that. He is a neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he told me that many people feel a commitment to the ideological ideas, the founding principles of America, and then there's also group identity. What do we know about group identity? When in our life do we start to develop that, and why do we develop it?
We develop it pretty quickly. It seems to be something that's, you know, baked into our brains, this tendency to form part of our own personal identities from the groups that we associate with. And the interesting thing about this is that it's incredibly flexible. You can decide what a group identity is. And you see there are all sorts of crazy different identities. I have a friend who's very committed to Ford truck owners versus Chevy truck owners and is often posting on Facebook, you know, disparaging remarks about Chevy truck owners and, you know, aggrandizing remarks about Ford truck owners. So there's a whole different set of arbitrary characteristics over which we can identify. And this gives us self-esteem. So we're motivated to do it. But one of the consequences is whenever we define a group, we often define our group in contrast to another group. And so we have our in-group, but then we also have an out-group.
From an evolutionary perspective, this makes sense though, right?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. A lot of our social cognition evolved when we were small groups, bands of humans trying to scrabble out an existence in competition with others, in fierce competition with others. So having a group of people who believe fervently in the morality and the goodness of their own group, who are helpful and kind and compassionate to those who they identify with, that was really beneficial. But also beneficial would be people who are willing to fiercely defend that group against invaders, against the other. So we now have the legacy of that evolutionary process. We now have the legacy of Stone Age psychology.
So at the base of patriotism, it seems, is the same decision I make every time I encounter another human, which I don't even realize I'm making, but it's kind of like good guy, bad guy, threat, or friend.
Yeah, this is the tendency. And even more than that, I think it affects how you process information. So if you're deeply patriotic, there are psychological biases that come into play that help you to keep that narrative that your group is good and worthy and moral, and the other group is unworthy and immoral. You process information coming in differently, that if there's information that confirms that worldview, you uncritically accept it and you weave it into your existing narrative. But if it's information that runs contrary to that view, you tend to critically evaluate it and pick it apart.
Does patriotism have to be sort of fostered in children to flourish? I'm thinking if somebody grows up in America and has lived here all their lives, would they end up being more patriotic than an American who's lived abroad all their lives?
Well, very young children quickly make group distinctions. They usually make it around fluency of the language of their mother. So there's a clear group favoritism, but of course, pre-verbal infants have no conceptualization of a national boundary or patriotism. That has to be taught, and that comes on later. But this tendency to think of the world in terms of in-group and out-group, that seems to be something that we're pre-wired with.
Any thoughts on, I'm sure this happens to lots of us, when, let's say, we see somebody sing the anthem, and everybody gets teary-eyed. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. The Olympics, they kill me, right? This, again, is this process that has kept us alive as humans. This is something that's powerful, and it's deep inside all of us. And I think it's important also to realize that you don't have to have a them to have an us. I was just talking with an astronaut, and she said that it's a universal experience that when astronauts go in space, this distinction between national boundaries just bleeds away, and they have a deep feeling of connection with the world.
Emile Bruneau is a neuroscientist, and he studies group identity and conflict. Things come to mind when we think about patriotic images, flags, the Statue of Liberty, and of course, the bald eagle, America's majestic national bird. But one of the founding fathers had lots of opinions about that bird, or more specifically, its character. In a letter to his daughter in 1784, Benjamin Franklin said this:
"For my own part, I wish the bald eagle had not been chosen the representative of our country. He is a bird of bad moral character. He does not get his living honestly."
He said that because bald eagles oftentimes swoop down and steal food from other birds. They also eat carcasses of dead animals instead of taking the time to hunt for their own fresh food. But that's not all that bothered Ben.
"Besides, he is a rank coward. The little kingbird, not bigger than a sparrow, attacks him boldly and drives him out of the district."
Then Ben goes on to endorse what he sees as a more suitable candidate, and he's able to put down the British in one fell swoop.
"For the truth, the turkey is in comparison a much more respectable bird, and withal a true original native of America. He is besides, though a little vain and silly, a bird of courage, and would not hesitate to attack a grenadier of the British Guards, who should presume to invade his farmyard with a red coat on."
So Ben Franklin is on Team Turkey all the way, rather than the
very lousy
bald eagle. I like the eagle. Turkeys have neck waddle. You can't be dignified with neck waddle. That was Science and the 4th of July, a special production from The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had help producing this week's show from Joel Wolfram and Alex Stern. Liz Tung is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Tanya English, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Turkeys just look silly and they're like, wah, 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 wah.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.